Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Right, so how was the Laver Cup for you?
The Laver Cup was, it was cool. It really was. It was a really good, fun few days. It was quite one-sided. We're missing a lot of big guns. So it was, yeah, but it was good. It was good fun. It's interesting. It's my first time being involved in the Laver Cup. And I really like it. I really like the format. Actually sitting down and, as I say, properly being involved. I like the format. I like the event. There's definitely some things that I would change, as it were, for me to make it better. I do think that it's in a different era now that you're post the big guys playing, and what's going to happen there. Of course, Federer got the biggest cheer of anyone anytime he was on the screen because he was in the front seat, of course. So, like, how can he be involved, or is he going to stay above it all, or how it's going to evolve will be interesting, because I think there is potential for wrong decisions to be made or for action not to be taken, and then for it to start to fizzle a little bit. Or there's the potential, I think, to get it really, really right and it really take off. I think it's been good up until this point. But as I say, you've had Federer, Nadal, Murray, Djokovic, you've had somebody in there each year. And then, yeah, now it's going to be fascinating, I think, in the direction it goes. But it was good fun.
I think for me, the question is, what is it? I think a lot of people are struggling with what is it and what should it be? And I think that came to a head with Félix Auger-Aliassime and Gael Monfils, who seemed to be on court having a discussion as to what is it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Monfils said, I was told I could come here and have fun. And Félix was like, I've been told this is the most important match of my life. So there you go. And there was a bit of a clash. Most of it happened in French, so I wasn't quite there. I needed you there to help me, but I didn't quite know what was going on. But yeah, it was also difficult because for Monfils, you can understand, right? Firstly, he's just come off the back of UTS in Frankfurt, which is a full exhibition, as in no one really is that bothered about the results. It's just about entertainment. And of course, Monfils is breakdancing and doing his thing, right? So I get it. So he was fresh off the back of that. So maybe still sort of in that spirit. Although look, he wasn't breakdancing or anything at Laver Cup. I think the initial confusion was about him taking too long and that sort of stuff. But there was no shot clock. So, you know, there we go. But yeah, so I think possibly he'd come from there, so still a little bit more in that mindset. But then also, if you're Gael Monfils, you're going, hang on a minute, I've been selected, I'm ranked 142, and I've won a handful of matches this year. How serious can this thing be? Like, that is a realistic response. I know Monfils is Monfils, and he's a big name, but in terms of being competitive, would that necessarily happen? I don't know.
But then you're getting Monfils in by saying, hey, Gael, come and join us. It's a lot of fun. We're going to sort of muck around to a degree and this and that. But that's not what the Laver Cup is billed as. So I'm sort of thinking, does it, I don't know, a lot of people saying in the aftermath, more doubles, you know, doubles is the really fun stuff. Should it be an exhibition? And there's nothing wrong with an exhibition. I think sometimes think, well, we're not going to take it seriously because it is an exhibition. I mean, do you see its future as, should it be a really good exhibition, or is it a very serious event that we need to be taken seriously? In that case, you've got to think about who takes part and how it's structured. And it feels a little entertaining, but it feels a little bit confused.
Yeah, and it could be either, really, to be honest. And that is quite exciting. I think it could be very successful as if it went either way. For me, I think it stems from the captains. And, of course, this Borg-McEnroe thing, totally get it. But McEnroe lost 4 in a row. And if you compare it to the Ryder Cup, Solheim Cup, which is what it is supposed to be compared to, or any major sporting event, if you lose 4 in a row, you're getting a new captain. You're not making it that far. I mean, if you mess up the Ryder Cup, that is a massive stain on, especially if you were supposed to win and you didn't, like what happened to Bjorn Borg last year. You know, on paper, they should have won and then they got and then they lost at home in London. You know, that's so I feel like there's no consequence to it. So, of course, yes, McEnroe absolutely loves to win, as he has, but I'm not sure the losses are as impactful, if you know what I mean. And I think, for me, I think that's the biggest thing. As in, if you lose four in a row, or if you lose on a year where you shouldn't lose, or if you get absolutely wiped like Bjorn Borg's team just did, when they shouldn't have really, like they just, a lot of them didn't perform very well. Team World, everybody performed to an amazing level. Then it's like, well, what's the... He just says, yeah, we'll try again next year. It's like, will you be back? You're going to be back. So I understand it's Borg and McEnroe. How can you fire Borg or McEnroe? But do you see what I mean? That for me is like, it can't be a proper competition unless there's something on the line, there's something at stake.
Yeah, that's when it feels a bit more exhibition-y, because yes, Borg and McEnroe, amazing names, amazing rival, amazing to have them. But as you say, there's no consequence. And Borg, he's not the loudest of captains on the sideline, is he, to put it mildly?
I don't think he said much at
all. Yes, he's beyond Borg, but he's not. That's when, again, it feels this bit of a hybrid. It's not sure what it's trying. I think you're right. If it was a fully serious Felix Auger-Aliassime, this is the most serious match of my life, then you mix up the captains and someone gets it who, I don't know, is going to put everything into it, or maybe deserves it, or puts their name forward to be captain. Or maybe you get Federer and Nadal in as captains. I don't know how you have them, but I don't know whose Team World out of that. But maybe it doesn't matter where the captain comes from. But it just, I don't know. I think it's a lot of fun, and it's fun to watch, but it was fun to watch this. And I'm working on the Rugby World Cup at the moment, so I've kind of been watching. So at the beginning of the Rugby World Cup, I had the Davis Cup and I had the rugby on, and then I was having a bit of Laver Cup and the rugby on, but I lost a bit of interest. Once the scoreline went quite one-sided, I was kind of done, which sounds awful as a tennis fan, but I was like, oh. Then I was just relying on your voice notes to tell me what happened.
But I think the main unique selling point is the interactions on the bench, is the coaching that you hear. So I've changed my opinion of quite a number of players just by seeing how they talk about matches.
Like who?
So it's just really fast. So Felix, for example, he was incredibly vocal on a very loud Team World. You got the likes of TFO, Paul, you've got Chris Eubanks. I mean, Eubanks was fantastic in terms of his analysis as well. But it was so interesting. And then sometimes it clashed. You know, Eubanks told Tommy Paul to go more middle. Like, oh yeah, just hit through the centre of the court. I think he was playing against Casper Ruud. And Tommy Paul was like, nah, not going to do that. But I think that's the real interesting bit. And even when McEnroe, of course, McEnroe's constantly banging on about, go to the net, go to the net, go to the net. But like, that's, for me, is the best bit, you know, at the changeovers and listening to that. And you get nothing from Borg. And that's just how he is. And I'm sure he does plenty of this stuff behind the scenes. But when there's a camera in his face, he doesn't want to say anything. I guess that's the thing. We got a lot from Thomas Enqvist, and you've got other people there. You know, that I find interesting. Like, I want to know how they speak about each other. So Team World, they were all completely together on Andre Rublev. He hates defending on his backhand. Just go do that. You know what I mean? And it's just that sort of stuff that they feel when they're on the court. And, you know, you just don't get a chance to hear it. And, you know, look, if Roger Federer was, say, the Team Europe captain, we would get to hear that insight from him. And that would be like gold dust, because we don't know really what they think. No one ever really talks that much about it in tennis in terms of general tactics. No one would ever say about Rublev, like, oh, well, his defensive backhand's rubbish. But that's what they think, yeah. But they would never say that. You know, look, we're talking about top 10 players, talking about other top 10 players here. Levels, right? It's clearly not rubbish. But you know what I mean? So I think that's the number one thing. But that has to have purpose, which means that it has to be worth something. It can't just be an exhibition, because then the information doesn't matter. So I think it needs to be sort of really, as I say, there needs to be something at stake. And you need to have captains or vice captains, because Enqvist was doing a lot of this work on Team Europe. You need to have captains or vice. I mean, Patrick McEnroe didn't get up from the bench once. He didn't get involved at all, because John had it all under control and so did the other players. So it's different styles, which is fine, but you have to have someone able to impart wisdom that we're really interested in.
I think if Roger Federer was your Team Europe captain because he's retired, who would be your nomination for Team World's captain if it has to be a retired player?
Roddick, maybe. I think if if you took Johnny Mack, if you took Mack and Borg out, then yeah, I think Roddick would be the go-to. I think Roddick, Del Potro is also another good one.
Do you think Del Potro would be vocal enough?
I think so. I think no, but I think it's quite interesting in this. Like, you do see different sides come out. I mean, Felix, it was so funny because, as I say, in such a loud team world, everybody's just super relaxed. And, you know, there's a lot of Americans, and there were five Americans, plus Milos. and then you've got, obviously, the two American captains. And then you had Francisco Cerundolo, who had a whale of a time. I think he was the only one who wasn't from the States or Canada. And he just absolutely loved it. He played brilliantly as well. But Felix, of course, he's so different to everybody else, right? He's just so ultimately professional and thoughtful and methodical. And then, you know, he just sort of lets loose. And by the end of it, he was sat in the change room smoking a cigar down in Champagne. It's great. What a transformation in 3 days.
I think you just got to join him in the. I think in the end he thought, I've just got to get involved. I've just got to join him. But it's going to be interesting to see what changes. You feel they have to make changes, but whether it's the captains, or, I mean, Roger Federer named his sort of ideal team Europe for next year. And I thought personally it was a little bit harsh that only Rublev, I love Rublev, but only Rublev kept his place, so that the competition hadn't even finished and he'd replaced the whole of team Europe, barring Andre Rublev.
Well, to be fair, the top five in the world are all from team Europe and none of them played. So, like, Rublev was the top player for team Europe and he's ranked number six. So that's quite extraordinary, I think, when it comes to who they're able to put on the team, and it was difficult for sure, I think, for Team Europe to get the team that they wanted.
It's hard, isn't it? Because this might lead very nicely onto something else I wanted to chat about this week, because it's such a busy calendar, and the players have got to look at their schedule. And I guess they've got to look at things like this. What are they doing it for? Are they doing it for points? Are they doing it for prize money? Are they doing it for profile? Are they doing it because they want to have a lot of fun? Because the calendar is non-stop. And this is something that's been highlighted at the moment with Elena Rybakina talking about performance buys and actually withdrawing from a tournament, saying in Tokyo, saying that her body's not quite ready. But ultimately the conversation began, and it's something we were talking about this. Normally we just press record and do the pod, but it's something we were chatting in the build up to this, because I hadn't really heard a lot about performance buys before Rybakina brought it to the attention of the world by writing on Instagram that she didn't have a buy in Tokyo as the third seed, because it was done on performances and she hadn't played the tournament before.
They're not 100% new, but nobody knew. I didn't know. And it seems like no one else really knew that it was happening. And Rybakina didn't know. So I guess the players weren't aware. The coaches weren't aware. Media didn't seem to be aware that it was just all of a sudden brought in. So it sort of felt like a little bit of a panic and a bit of a reaction to the weaker field in Guadalajara for a 1,000 event. It was incredibly weak. You know, that's just how it is. And it felt like I think that's probably why this went down poorly with Rybakina, because it felt like it was a punishment. It felt like they were saying, no one's turned up to Guadalajara, so we're going to do performance buys, and the players that did well in Guadalajara, they can be awarded their buys. They can reap the benefits. You know what I mean? That's how it sort of came across, because of the timing of it, the fact that there was no sort of build up, no announcement, no one knew it was going to happen. It felt really out of the blue and like a reaction to that tournament. And the thing is that may not have been the case. It might have been completely coincidental, because the way that it's actually pitched is it's much more of a reward thing, and it's just about getting from one tournament to the other, and it incentivizes players to play a slightly more dense schedule to go from one place to the other. Obviously, Guadalajara is quite an anomaly in terms of where it is. You know, we're in the Asian swing. That's where we are.
Yeah.
But they're playing in Guadalajara. It's not in Asia. So, and it's 2 weeks after the US Open, which is the end of the American swing. So I love Guadalajara. I think the tournament's amazing. The two big events we've had there recently have been fantastic. I get it, but this is it. It feels very shoehorned in, and I can totally understand players not wanting to play. And then off the back of that, to say to Rybakina, "Oh well, because you didn't play, you're not getting a bye," I think that's why it went down in a bit of a negative way. I don't know.
Now, as we've said, that they're not new, and a lot of chatter on social media said sort of on the notes for the tournament, it did talk about performance buys and that they would be allocated. But for me, it seems, and I sort of get it from a tournament and a tour's point of view, they want the players turning up. They want the best players turning up. They want each event wants the big players at their event. But at the same time, you might disagree with this, but I feel it quite unfair on the player, because shouldn't the player be allowed to play their schedule as to how they're feeling? So it almost feels if you didn't play an event because you didn't feel quite right, you're therefore being punished, and then you're having to play through, and that could be more damaging. So basically, I don't understand how you find a level there, because you've got individual contractors thinking, crikey, I'm going to be punished if I don't play this tournament. But if I play this tournament, it's not good for my body. And the tournament is saying, well, we're going to do this because we want players in. Because if we don't get the big players in, maybe we lose fans and we lose sponsors to the tournament. So I don't really see how you get a balance. It doesn't really seem fair to me on the players.
Yeah, it's very difficult, ultimately, because if you're the WTA, you need to sell the product, and you need to have the stars there to sell the product, and you need them guaranteed from a long time in advance so the tournament has time to get the sponsors in to pay for their prize money for lots of different things. And the prize money is pushed up every year by the WTA, because they're trying to close the pay gap between the women and the men. But every time they push that up, that puts more strain on the tournament to find more sponsors to be able to pay for that money. And I know there's a number of tournaments, that have just not been able to keep up with those increases, even though a lot of people on the outside will look at it and say, well, these increases are way too slow. Like, you need to go faster, but it's not about that. You'll lose a lot of tournaments because they just can't finance it. And you could argue money should come from elsewhere. That's a different conversation, but the structure is as it is at the moment. They have a product to sell, and they need their players to turn up. And it's really it's difficult when you don't know who's going to play where. That's where it's really difficult. But then you can say that it's tennis's fault, the WTA and ATP, for putting on so many bloody tournaments every year. It's every week of the year. It's relentless. It's ridiculous. So, it's hard. They're already penalised for not playing. Even if you're just legitimately injured, you're penalised for not playing in a lot of tournaments. There are a number of mandatory events, and you get a mandatory zero on your ranking. So it can have a big impact. But it's hard. I see what you're saying, in that players should be able to do what they want with the schedule. I suppose I don't quite buy into that 100%. I think there does need to be an element of consistency, as in, like, you are expected to play X, Y, and Z. And I think a mandatory zero is a fair way to do it. I think that's fine. It becomes difficult when they start coming up with just ludicrous scheduling. Like, Guadalajara, it's just not the time for Guadalajara. Like, I'm sorry, it's terrible. Like, it's a disaster for that to be happening. Everybody's tired, it's deep in the season. And then you've got, what's the difference from the final eight? Where's that going to be? In Cancun? That came out of the blue. Cancun, we thought it was going to be in Prague. We were hearing it might be Prague. And then all of a sudden, like, we're going to Cancun, everybody. And then they've got to get to Seville. Is it Seville for...
Yep. The Billie Jean King Cup finals.
And you're talking days difference, right? They are flying halfway around the world and expected to play within days. It is it's absolutely brutal, and everybody wants to have a long career, which is understandable. Look, the thing is that the difference between tennis and other sports, like football, for example, football, you don't have a choice. You are contracted, you play when you're told to play, you don't play when you're told not to play, that's it. It's really just, yes, you can have some sort of collaboration. I'm sure people aren't completely awful all the time. But it's the same if you're in F1 or whatever, like, as in, you're paid a salary and contracted to do a million and one things, and you have to do it. Tennis isn't like that. The only thing is that you can choose not to go and play Indian Wells, but you'll take a mandatory zero. So there's a bit of give and take, if you know what I mean, because it is different to pretty much all other sports. I suppose golf is fairly similar, but golf has a bit less travel. But there is a lot of freedom and flexibility as a tennis player.
I just think it's tough because how many times, we saw this last year, you get to the WTA, the ATP finals, and you have these broken people who, was it Pegula that didn't win a match or a game or anything at the WTA? You know, you get these broken individuals that have sort of done everything they can to qualify and get there, and there's nothing left. And despite having already qualified for the WTA finals, they're still, which a chunk have now, they're still playing tournaments that they have to slash they want to, and you get to a point where at the end of the season you've got this sort of showpiece event, and added to that, the Masters events are longer now. So we saw that this year with Madrid and Rome, these really long events, and that the tour could say yes, but it gives them longer in between the matches, but at the same time it means they're not switching off. I think Iga Świątek said this. Yes, they're longer, so you're not playing day in, day out, but we don't get that rest, you know, those few days rest when they wouldn't have been a tournament.
Yeah, it's madness that they can think like this. I don't understand. Do they not consult players at all? Who would say that a 2-week Grand Slam is, it's fine because we get a day off in between matches? Everybody says it's exhausting to be in that state for 2 full weeks. Like, why? Who on earth thought that, like, oh, well, they'll get a bit of extra rest between matches? It's just nonsense. Of course, I totally agree with Iga. And I think every player would turn around and be like, no. 2-week events are, like, really hard. And everybody's wiped at the end of a slam, especially if you've gone all the way. Like, it's you know, and especially with the women, they're playing best of three sets there and they're playing best of three sets elsewhere. But it's still so much tougher. What's wrong with people?
How about getting rid of buys altogether? Not just performance buys, but why do we need, but how often do we see a player, one of the top seeds in a Masters, who comes in the second round and will lose or will really struggle because they've just suddenly come and effectively cold? They're playing someone that's either come through qualifying or had a first round match, or they're given to the people that maybe don't need the buy. I don't know. Why do we have buy? Is it just to convince or get the top players in because they'll have a slower / easier start? How about buys go?
Yeah, the buys are there to encourage the top players to play more tournaments. Because even if you're going to, say, a 250 event, you're not going to start until the Wednesday, sometimes a Thursday. Sometimes, the top players will just play Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Those will be their 4 matches. And you think you're so far into the tournament and they haven't even seen them yet. And that's it. And it becomes a short week because it's four matches, 4 days. So they are just more likely to come play a 250 and win it. 250 points, that's tough to get. That's not easy to get in even some of the bigger events. You still have to go very, very deep and play much, much tougher players. So if you're ranked sort of 12 in the world or 10 in the world, something to a 250, that is helpful for it all to be condensed. And we see that with all the big players. It means they can come in later. It's just, it's less work. That's ultimately what it is. They're having to do less work. And that's the benefit of being seeded highly, I suppose. It's just another thing that tips everything in the better players' favour. It's always like that, whether it's the fact that they're seeded, so they're going to get better draws. Because, you know, why do you have to have seeds? Why can't you all just go into a hat and just be pulled out one by one and it's fair for everybody? So it's already unfair. It's already weighted towards them. Then, of course, the scheduling favours them. Then they get a bye. Then they get more practice time. They get the practice time that they want. They get a full court. You only get half a court. Whatever it is, you know, it all adds up. It's just another one, I suppose. So, like, sure, you could get rid of it, but you could get rid of any of those things that make it unfair.
I know. And the other argument is, isn't it, that you work this hard, so therefore you should reap the rewards of working that hard and having that ranking. So this, I feel we could do about 3 hours on this and we could end up repeating ourselves and going round, because I can see the argument the other side of thing. I just think I just feel a little bit for the players and their bodies that they're not able to have as much say as to their schedule, despite being the player that she is, Rebecca, and it still feels she's sort of beholden and she can't have the control that maybe she should have.
It's that it came out of the blue, though, isn't it? I think that's the biggest problem. It's the communication, because, you know, you can understand from the WTA's perspective, they've gone, all right, Elena, you're Grand Slam champion. You didn't want to come to Guadalajara because you think that it's too much effort and too much strain on your body. So that's fine. And then you can play an extra match in Tokyo.
See, when you say it like that, makes sense. That makes sense to me.
It's like, okay, so you've let the other players will be making that journey and will be coming in jet lagged and late and everything. You'll get your main preparation and everything. So sure, just play an extra round.
Yeah,
you're still seeded. You're still getting. It's against Noskova. You're not playing the first round against Świątek, are you? Like, as in, it's an extra match. So you're going to do your work there, and that's how they're trying to make it fairer. So you can totally understand.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
One reason I'm really, really glad that Guadalajara happened, and it happened when it did, and it was slotted where it was, is because Maria Sakkari won it. And we were talking recently on the pod about how distressing it was to see her in tears after a first round loss at the US Open. It was the Greek side, the press conference, where she was talking about something needed to change, stepping away, what does she do? And it was the reaction to the fans. It was the love, she said, that she felt from the fans that kept her going. And yes, we can talk about a disrupted field, a weaker field, but she still had to go out there with everything she's dealing with mentally and get the job done. And she got the job done, and very happy for her.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, we all love Maria, don't we? She's just such a she's such a worker, and she really wears her heart on her sleeve. And you feel like she's very honest with, you know, what she's dealing with. I mean, what was it, 4 years from her last title?
2015 was her last title. 2019.
Maybe. I think 2019. You double check. I'll carry on. I think it was 4 or 5 years. Okay. So 4 or 5 years from her last title. And I think people don't understand that she's been a top 10 player for a large chunk of that. And if you think that means every single week she's played, she's lost. She will always finish on a defeat. And you get why that just eats away at you every time you're finishing on a negative. It's a loss. It's a disappointment. For years and years and years, that is brutal. But still, you're being so successful because you're in the top 10, right? It's a bit of a weird one to get your head around. And sure, yeah, it's a weaker field. But ultimately, she's played lots of other tournaments, smaller tournaments, where the field has been very similar. And she's still not won those as well. So it's still a big achievement for her to come out on top and be able to take the title anyway.
4 years and 4 months since her last tournament. And a couple of things she said post-match was she wanted to thank her coach, Tom Hill, because that's the first and the obvious one, isn't it? It's exactly as she said. People say, well, you need to make a change. And you were talking about that, the Laver Cup and the Ryder Cup. If you don't win it, you're probably going to change the captain. And Maria Sakkari would have got a lot of, well, why didn't you make a change in your coaching team? Because something's obviously not working. She didn't, and they've reaped the reward. And the other thing she said, that she was inspired by Coco Gauff speaking at the US Open. You know, when she talked about the haters, and basically, I'm going to channel the haters. And she said, look, we live in a world with social media. It's out there. You're going to see what's written. You're going to hear what's written. But, you know, she also took that people have bigger problems than just not winning a tennis match. And also, she's going to channel the haters, which she did. And it was, look, she's worked really hard. As we always say with tennis, you can't work quietly. You're working publicly, week in, week out, in front of a crowd, with an opponent, out there for all to see. And she's overcome it.
Yeah. I don't know. I find the haters thing a bit funny. I mean, obviously, there are some awful people on social media. I get it. But yeah. I do also recognise that they are talking about people who commentate on what they do. And I'm not talking about commentate as in necessarily on air, but just comment in general, as in it's your job to, like, it's our job to. I mean, we talked about it with Maria Sakkari. We talked about her potentially changing her coach. Yeah. It doesn't make us haters. I don't see that as negativity. It's an opinion, right? Sure, I mean, people saying that they're they're rubbish or whatever. I don't know, it's hard because, you know, Coco Gauff's there going, oh, you know, everyone, you know, people have been talking about my forehand and I, you know, never be strong enough to win a slam. And it's like, but all of that is a relevant conversation. I don't think anybody has done anything wrong in having that conversation. I mean, yes, there are other people who would just turn around and say that she's a waste of space, which is, you know, outrageous to say. But yeah, I mean, if they want to use it as fuel, then that's fantastic. But I don't think people should be made to feel bad for having an opinion and talking about where people can get to, because ultimately that's what the fans are really fascinated in, is the potential of players. You know, I'm asked about every single player and I've got no idea. You know, you give your best take based on certain information. But, you know, that's part of it, is people like the chat around stuff, and they like to... You know, people do like to be armchair experts, and that's just part of sport, right? It's just a part of it. And I think it's hard because they are individual athletes, so they obviously take it all on themselves, and they probably do take it quite personally. But it's not; it's just a professional opinion. But hey, if they use it as fuel to win a slam like Coco did, and win her first Masters, or to win the Masters first title in 4 years and 4 months, like, great, go for it.
Someone else I'm very happy for, because I think we both have a soft spot for her, is Sofia Kenin, winning the Australian Open in, what, 2020. Then she had a lot of things to deal with. She had a lot of illness. She had a lot of injury. In the last 2 weeks, she's gone from 93 in the world to 31. I think she's something like 8-2 since the US Open. And I like the strut. I like the fact she doesn't look when she tosses the ball. I like the fact that her dad is just going through every emotion. No one ever looks happy in the Kenin camp, in the Kenin world. But I like the attitude. I like the strut. And I really like the fact that she's got herself back into a good position and she's winning matches and reaching finals.
She is. And yes, so back into a final. And I think she's definitely back, not quite back to her best, but it's coming. And it's been painfully slow for her, hasn't it? I don't know how she handled like a full year of just not really being able to win a match at all and trying and really, really trying. And she just couldn't beat anyone at all. I mean, how is that possible as a Grand Slam champion? I don't know how you can come to terms with that. You can understand your level dropping. I think for a lot of people, you can understand the level dropping from Grand Slam champion to like a 150 sort of level. You need to go through the challenges and stuff. Look, that level is tough. It's really, really hard. And the most dangerous thing you can do is drop down to that level when you are low in confidence. And then all of a sudden you can't win matches there. And then you're hitting rock bottom. And a lot of people make that mistake. And sometimes it's through poor scheduling or maybe not being realistic with where their level is at. And they might come back from an injury and go, yep, I'm going to take my wild cards. I'm going to play tour events. I'm going to get going again. They lose. And then they continue on with that, you know, using their protected ranking, do that for the best part of a year, drop down to challengers, and they've got no confidence. And then they start losing there as well. And then where do you go? You have to start from scratch. For Kenin, it was slightly different, but, you know, yeah, she's had to be really humble about it, right? You have to just completely start from scratch. She has had to claw this back, and it's come really slowly as well. I think a lot of people think, oh yeah, but when it clicks, then off you go. It's like, no, she came through qualifying at Wimbledon. She's there as a Grand Slam champion playing at Wimbledon qualifying. It's not even on site. It's, you know, it's a different ground. It's hard. It's really hard. But like the strike that she has is quality. I think, to be honest, I actually think the only thing holding her back at the moment is her physical side and her fitness. I think that's going to come, like her match fitness with the more matches that she played. Like at Wimbledon, she lost to Svitolina, I think, in the third round, maybe. And she was just toast, just physically toast, because she'd come through qualies, won a couple of matches, beaten Coco Gauff. So she was just done. So I think as soon as that gets to be at a good level, or at a higher level, then she'll be right back in the mix, and she'll be dangerous.
There are 10 American women in the top 50 now, which is absolutely incredible. Coco Gauff leading the way. Now, so what's next for you work-wise?
Beijing.
Oh, lovely.
Beijing starts. It's weird, right? It's weird because I'm doing it for the men. It's a Thursday to Wednesday tournament. we start the first round Thursday. Oh. Finals on Wednesday.
Oh, I'd get so confused. I wouldn't know what day it is.
I know. Oh, I know. I'm going to feel unwell for the entire thing. Oh. I don't know what's going to go on, to be honest. Cool. And that's because it's then Shanghai, which is now a longer event because it's now 10 days.
Shanghai has wanted to be longer forever. I mean, Shanghai has been gunning to be longer forever, and it's finally Thursday to Wednesday. Oh, I'd be absolutely all over the place with that. I have it tough enough with Roland Garros because it starts on a Sunday, so I'm always
you're like jet lagged for a few days. You're like, what's happening?
I don't know what's. So I'm still going on the Rugby World Cup up until including the final of the Rugby World Cup, but I'm also mixing in a few weeks' time Hong Kong for the WTA. So yeah, by morning, I'll be doing Hong Kong. And by evening, at the back end of the week, I'll be doing the rugby. So just doing a little bit of mixing things up. And I was wondering, we were having a chat before we came on air about schools and children and parents sort of asking too much. And we've spoken before about like pushy parents and stuff. I think maybe I need to be a bit pushier because the boys have got some... They've got some football trials this evening, and I've been all I keep saying is don't expect to get in. Instead, because I'm trying to protect them. Is this wrong? I'm trying to protect them by dampening expectations because they're sort of saying, and it's a trial associated with a foundation of a club, right? So they're looking at the name of the club, going, we're going to get in. Are these players going to be there? And I just keep, rather than those parents that go, you're going to get in, and if you don't get in, and if you did, I'm kind of like, you're not going to get. I say it in a nice way, but I'm kind of, am I doing the wrong thing? I'm trying to protect them by giving them. Wanting them to do their best, but giving them no expectations. Is that wrong?
Yeah, I don't know. The worst thing you can do is tell them they're going to get in.
Well, that's exactly. Exactly.
So you're not doing that. No. So that's good. I wouldn't necessarily advise that. Look, I'm not the expert on parenting, must say. But I think you want to say, look, we don't know what the level is going to be like. That is an unknown. Yeah. Yeah. We know what your level is. Yeah. We know that you've got a chance. Yeah. Got a good chance.
Give it your best.
So you're going to go. You're going to really give it your best. We're going to make sure you've had a good meal the night before. You've had your
lovely
your breakfast. Yeah. You're ready to go. You know, you give it your absolute best, and then we'll see. You've definitely got a good chance. You want to give them positivity, make them feel like it's possible. But that it's not definitely going to happen.
Because I'm quite a pessimist personally for myself. I'm always a glass half empty. That I'm hoping I'm not sort of putting... So I keep saying things like, you know, it could be a case of... Because as we know, I know how football clubs work. You know, if they've got 10 left-footers, 10 left-backs, at a trial, they're going to be looking for some right-sided players. So I said to the boys, it could be as simple as, you're really, really good, but they've got a lot of you in that position, so they might just not need another 10... right wingers or something. So
yeah, of course.
Just, so I'm sort of tapering, but I've done the, we don't know what the level is, give it your best. And one of the boys, one of the twins, one of the fellas, he loves a two-footed tackle from behind. And I'm like,
oh, nice.
I'm like, I know it looks dramatic and you love doing them, but could you just not do them this evening? Can we just not have any two-footed tackles? And he kind of looks at me grinning. I'm like, oh, I'm not sure how this is going to end up. So, yeah, okay, right. A bit more positivity.
Yeah, just tell them that we don't know what they're looking for.
We don't know what they're looking for.
We know that you're playing at a good level. We know that you've got a chance, but, you know, we can't control what they're looking for. It might not be the right time. Or it might be.
Right. I might.
So let's go and see.
I might ring you to do the pre-trial chat a little bit later. And if I don't ring you, if I manage to get through it, then we will reconvene next week.
Yes, perfect.
All right. Speak to you then. Bye.
Bye.